finished up our discussion of AC circuits.
Felt final, I guess.
And we did that by looking at LRC circuits, which you can think of as a pretty general case for circuits, because it's hard to imagine one that doesn't actually have some of all of that. And if you basically then do Kirchhoff's law, the EMF here goes as Emax sine theta sine omega t, sort of by definition, and then you'll have a voltage drop across the resistor, the capacitor, and the inductor. And we've discussed how. Do you have a question? This needs to be a minus sign again. Is that what you said? Yeah. You know, when you get one bug, sometimes it just propagates. The danger of cut and paste. So
we've looked at what happens across each of the circuit elements relative to this changing voltage, changing EMF, and we sort of extracted these expressions where the phases are different across the capacitor and the inductor, and you have this thing which acts like a resistance across the capacitor and this thing that acts like a resistance across the inductor. And so we've looked at all that. But in the more general case, so you can sort of argue, or you can say, look, the current in this thing is going to have a frequency that's basically going to have to be driven by the frequency of the CMF. And it'll have some maximum value. And what you really don't know is how is its phase going to be relative to the phase of the EMF. And you don't really know what its magnitude is going to be. So you have to solve for those. And we didn't do it, but when you solve for those, you find that you can get an expression for the phase angle that depends on the reactive and inductive capacitances, reactive and inductive resistances, and the resistance itself. And then if you solve for Imax, you get this strange quantity, which if you don't have chi L and chi C, then this basically is V over R, and so it sort of boils down to what you think of as normal DC type circuit. But you do have the capacitive and inductive reactances in this thing, and so if you look at what happens, though, so these being non-zero will tend to add some resistance in here and reduce on that. So if you minimize this piece by reducing that as far as it will go, you'll end up maximizing on that. And it turns out that if you go back and you look at what the capacitive and inductive reactances are, at a frequency, when the frequency approaches 1 over the square root of LC, these two things will cancel out, and then you'll get a minimal resistance and a maximal current, and in fact, you'll get a resonance, so you might have some current in the circuit, and then if you're changing the frequency of the EMF, when you approach this, then you'll get that. Of course, usually you're not changing the frequency of the EMF. Usually you're changing a capacitance or an inductor, so you have a fixed frequency, and then you're actually changing the LC. But whenever these two approach each other, you'll get a spike in the current. So it's sort of interesting. And an example of sort of the richness that you can begin to get out of the time dependence of circuits. So if you want to know more, take an engineering class. They do it there. But we're not going to do a lot with it. It's the kind of thing that you sort of, actually, probably you're going to learn some of it in labs, and there may be, I don't know, do you have a virtual electronics class in physics? I don't know what we do, but there may be something in there. But the kind of stuff you sort of learn is you have to learn it, usually, in physics curricula. Anyway, then we started talking about magnetism and materials, and it's a bit richer than what we saw with the electric fields and materials.
in that you sort of have three cases instead of the two that you tend to have in terms of magnetism and non-conductive materials. You have substance called paramagnetic, where the material is made up of things that you can think of as being little current loops or little bar magnets. So these are atoms or nuclei or whatever that have, depending on the material and how sensitive you are, they have an inherent magnetic moment. So they look like little bar magnets. And you can just think of them that way. And then what happens if they are not they'll tend to be able to reorient because things are knocked around thermally, etc. And these are not super, super strong. So their interaction with each other, although it is there, isn't strong enough to really align them locally too much. So if you have such a situation and you put it in an external B field, you'll produce a torque on each of these little bar magnets that will tend to try to align them along the field. And the stronger the B, the more alignment you'll get. So this is very, very similar to the kind of thing that you saw in dielectrics, in that you might expect to see sort of a linear increase in the B field inside the material due to the alignment of these things as you increase the B field externally. We have a case where you have ferromagnetic materials, with iron being the main one, that sort of the canonical one, where these unpaired spins in the iron atom give it such a strong magnetic moment that you have basically them talking to each other quite a bit. And if you have iron cooled down so that it's, you know, it's in its crystalline structure, it turns out that you'll get local regions of fairly strong alignment. And if this is randomized enough, you can have a piece of iron that has no magnetic field at all. But if you now put an external magnetic field on it, it will begin to exert a torque, and what you'll get is domains of these regions are called domains. They'll begin to shift, and again, you'll have some degree of shifting linear in some sort of linear-like fashion, not exactly, and it can depend very much on the temperature and the alloy of the iron, exactly how this happens. But here, you'll get B increased. For your typical paramagnetic material, you have enough things sort of moving around, and the individual bar magnets in there are not super-duper strong. So what happens is you typically have an increase in the B field, but not all that strong. In ferromagnetic materials, you have strong dipoles, and you'll get pretty good alignment and a strong field. And you can get quite a big enhancement of the magnetic field, up to about 2 tesla. At 2 tesla, all of these things are aligned, and you have about as strong a field as you're going to produce conventionally. If you want to go to a... So let me remind myself what I have on the next slide, because whether I want to talk about this now or wait a second. Okay, I'll come back to that. So in iron, there's this additional thing called diamagnetic materials, where you don't have the little bar magnets that make up the material, but when you put in a magnetic field, it effectively induces bar, little magnetic bar magnets, you can think of them, but with an opposite polarity from the field. So you can think of these as induced fields in terms of classical intuition, which of course, since this field might be constant, that picture doesn't really quite hold up. But in this case, you can actually get a material that will weaken the B field a little bit inside. So, as we talked about last time, in an analogy to what we did with electric fields in the material, we tried to quantify all this by basically putting in a linear piece here. It is a linear piece in spite of the fact that it's so complicated. The field inside the material is equal to this constant or set of constants times the external B field, often called the free field. And this constant is called magnetic susceptibility. This combination is the relative permeability, this Km. And this combination is called the permeability. You know mu zero, so you could have a table of chi m's, you could have a table of this Km's, or you could have a table of mu's and get the information you need out of it. In the end, if this Km, this piece, is greater than 1, so if chi m is greater than 1, then you greater than 1, you'll have paramagnetism. If it's much greater than 1, then you have a big enhancement of this B field, then it's ferromagnetism. And if it is less than 1, so that this quantity being less than 1 will give you a slightly weaker field in free space. So it's a little bit richer. So I want to talk just a minute about iron. We did a bit at the end of class last time, but it's particularly useful. It turns out that for a relatively weak external field, you can get a pretty strong internal field in the iron. And so this leads to the idea of an electromagnet, where you can use some current in a loop to produce a field, and then you'll get this effective magnification in the strength of the field if you put a chunk of iron in the middle of it. And the more current you run in your loop, the stronger is the external field, the stronger becomes the field in the iron. So you get this nice magnification. So if you sort of draw it out where this is the free field, and I didn't try to get the scales just right, where you have the free field and the field in the iron, you can actually get the field to increase in the iron up until you get a field inside the iron of about 2 tesla, which is a good number to keep in mind. And the reason for that is because if you just have a current loop, you have to burn a lot of power to maintain a strong field. If you put a chunk of iron in there, you don't have to burn as much power in the current loop in order to have a nice strong field. You also have a way of using the iron, the shape of the iron, to help specify what the shape of the magnetic field is going to be. So your basic idea of using magnets in the lab and stuff, usually you try to base it with iron cores for this reason. And you can get, if you really want to do that, you have to worry about details like the alloy of the iron and things like that. It can make a difference. But the geometry can help define exactly what the field looks like in the region you want to study. So it's something you'll see a lot. The 2 tesla is good to keep in mind, because basically what it says is if you want a field that's stronger than 2 tesla, it's got to come from your current loop, which, if it's not a superconducting current loop, is going to be a lot of power after a while if you're running it very much. So what you find is that if you can do things below 2 tesla, and somebody wants to do it with superconducting magnetic loop, you should ask them, why would you want to do that? Because superconductors are much more expensive and hard to deal with than iron. And it doesn't make any sense. If you want to go above 2 tesla, then it starts to make a lot more sense. And so you'll see, for example, devices in hospitals and things, when they need a really strong field, then they have to deal with that. It tends to make the things much bigger and much more expensive. So, any questions? Okay. So let me remind you that if we have this infinite wire, we can solve for the field around it by drawing
a circular loop around it. And then using Ampere's law, we say that the integral of B dot ds around the loop as you go around, so I have little ds elements here, and let's say that I have an infinite current going that way.
So what will happen is I'll have a circulating B field that has a symmetry that will fall off as an R, but it has no angular dependence. And so this B dot ds
is equal to mu zero times the current that I have enclosed. All right, so you've seen that before. Let's take this same current and put a gap in it with capacitive plates. Let's imagine that I start with the current being zero and then start putting current in there. Do I have a current?
I mean, we know if we are charging up a capacitor, we have a current in the circuit, okay? So I can imagine having a similar situation where I have this gap. And now comes sort of an interesting hole that we have in Ampere's law.
I can draw my circle here as I would normally, except this time I want to make it orange. And you could try to argue that Ampere's law still holds true in that circle as I go around, and it does, because just like Gauss's law holds true for all enclosed surfaces, Ampere's law holds true for whatever curve I decide to draw. That doesn't matter. So this curve works pretty well. Then the question is, what does Ampere's law represent? What does that curve represent? And what do we mean by the surface through which the current goes? We're really talking about sort of the current flux going through this surface. And you can actually, Ampere's law should work for the situation where this is the curve that subtends the surface, but the surface can be some strange surface. It could be like a vacuum cleaner bag or something. And Ampere's law is still supposed to work.
But if you were to try to look at Ampere's law and you say that this curve now is subtending this strange surface, if you look at that weird surface, there is no current that actually penetrates through that surface if you manufacture it this way. So there's actually a sort of this loophole or this problem that exists for Ampere's law.
And James Clerk Maxwell noticed this and didn't like it. So he introduced another term. And by the way, you're going all the way around the circle. So very often when people say you're going to integrate around the loop, they put a circle there. It's another thing that makes it look cooler than what you usually learn in calculus. So it's a good thing to do. So you take Ampere's normal law, and then Maxwell added a term. And in fact, we call this term, we called it the displacement current. And this term is designed to fix the problem.
So if I am charging up a capacitor, I will have a changing electric flux going through, going in that region between capacitor plates. And so if you add a term that is dependent on the changing electric flux, you'll find that you, I mean, it'll be non-zero during the time that you have a current flowing in the wire. And it's enough that, you know, it works.
So this is one of Maxwell's big contributions, simply seeing that you have to have this term in there. And I'll let you play with that term in a few homework problems. The reason that I wanted to put it there was not to really play with it very much right now, but because we actually need it in order to see how all these equations fit together. So what I'd like to do now is to sort of remind us of where we've been. What we found was that if we integrate over the surface of a closed surface, E dot dA, so if we integrate the flux around the closed surface, we get Q enclosed divided by epsilon naught, okay? And this we call Gauss's law.
We have no such thing for magnetism in terms of magnetic point charge, the monopole, magnetic monopole. Theoretically, such a thing could exist, but if you go and look very, very hard, you won't find it. So
what that really means mathematically is that if you write down this law for magnetism, you get zero. That's Gauss's law for magnetism. Basically, it's a statement that there exists no magnetic monopole. And we just saw what happens with Ampere. So if we take Ampere's law and we write it down, we do an integral around a closed loop of B, could be dS, could be dL, as you go around the loop, you get mu zero. And I want to write the current in a different way. I want to write the current in terms of the current density that's going through it. So this is, of course, nothing but I enclosed. So you've done calculations like that before. Then I'm going to add Maxwell's displacement term. Okay, so that's sort of the new form of Ampere's law that is all-inclusive. And then we have induced EMF equation that we've seen. Which tells us that a changing magnetic flux inside a loop will induce an EMF around that loop. And this is actually known as Faraday's law. So Maxwell's the one who wrote down this term, so he's the one who really pulled together these four equations for the first time. This set of equations are what we call the integral form of Maxwell's equations. And these four equations encapsulate all that we know about electromagnetism pre-quantum. So, oddly enough,
we're not going to do anything with these four equations. very anticlimactic. It turns out that the integral form of Maxwell's equations in each case makes a lot of sense. In other words, you know, teaching Gauss's law by doing this integral around the surface and everything makes a lot of sense. And so that's really how you think about these things. But it turns out that if you really want to now extract some of the really cool stuff from these equations, this form isn't so useful. So what I want to do is to transform these equations into a different form, which is what we call the differential form. Because it turns out that the differential form of Maxwell's equations allows you to pull some really neat stuff out and understand what we're seeing. So that's what I'm going to do. And we'll come back and we'll look at those forms in time. So I want to give you a little bit of a heads up now. I'm about to go a little bit nuts in doing some vector calculus manipulations up here, okay? It is not something I expect you to be doing on your exam. But I want you to see it, and I want to try to explain where it's all coming from, because when you take your 217 exams, you will be expected to do it. And you will probably re-derive this in 217. It would be my expectation that you do. It's the kind of thing that's probably good for you to have actually seen once before you're actually expected to start just being able to eat and breathe it. And depending on who you have for 217, I might just be saving your butt right now because they may not explain it. I don't know. At any rate, I think it's worthwhile sort of seeing where this comes from. Depending on how much math or what, you know, other stuff you've had, you may have seen some of this already. But I think there's a lot of interesting stuff here that's useful to learn. So that's a little bit of an apology, okay? But I don't want you to sort of look at this and think, oh my God, you know, how are we going to do that on a test? Because I'm not going to ask you to do this on a test, but I do want you to see it. So it's very much worthwhile, in my opinion. Okay, so if you recall, we have seen this vector operator before, which goes by the name of del, which is equal to the partial derivative in the x direction, the partial derivative with respect to x in the x direction, plus the partial derivative with respect to y in the y direction, plus the partial derivative with respect to z in the z direction. And we call it a vector operator because it's not a vector, really. It's a mathematical operator that acts, that has vector components, but if you multiply something by del, you're taking these derivatives. It actually operates. Okay, so it's a little different beast.
So we define something called the divergence of a vector field. And I'm going to do this in Cartesian coordinates. The divergence of a vector field V is where you take the dot product of del with V. And if you look at what happens, is it means you're taking the derivative in the x direction of the x component of V, the derivative in the y direction of the y component of V, and the derivative of the z component of V in the z direction. And you add these things together, and you have a scalar, because this is a dot product. Sometimes this is written as div v. That would be the same thing. So I guess I just defined it that way. If you look at what we're doing, that's the del vector. You dot it into your V vector. And so this will give you terms. So you can expand it out like that, and what you see is the only terms where the dot product here is 1 are going to be the terms where you have I dot I hat, J dot J hat, and C dot K dot K hat. Sorry, I think I told you earlier in the semester that I will just randomly do Z hats and K hats and stuff. Sorry, it's just going to come out. I can erase it and fix it right now, but it'll be back in two steps. I don't know. At any rate, so you end up with only these terms, and this is a scalar, which is 1, and so you're just left with those three terms. Now, look at what's happening. You're looking at the rate of change of the vector x in the x direction, the rate of change of the vector of the y component in the y direction, the rate of change of the z component in the z direction. So you're really looking at how much this vector field sort of increases or decreases as it moves away from a point. It would be the divergence of that point. If you have a field that is constant at that point, it has no rate of change in any of those quantities, the divergence is 0. If your point is, say, the center of a charge, the electric field is growing, you know, it's changing dramatically as you go out radially. So you're going to have a very non-zero divergence. So a way to think about the divergence is it's sort of the degree to which the field is like water coming out of a point or going into a point, like a sinkhole or something. So think about it that way. So it's the degree. So mentally, you would say something where a field does this at that point would clearly have a divergence, because the field is changing, sort of going out. This field would have is equal to zero. Okay.
Think of it as the rate of change, sort of a measure of the change in the field as you think about it radially, coming in or coming out. If it has a lot of that, then it has a large divergence.
So now that we've defined that, I want to make use of something that you have probably seen in math classes. It's called Gauss's theorem. Sometimes it's called Green's theorem. And sometimes it's called the divergence theorem. And basically what it says is that if I do the integral over the divergence of a field in a volume, it's equal to the flux of that field through the surface that subtends that volume. And I'm not proving that to you, I'm just giving that to you. So now, if you think about what we have, E dot dA is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. E dot dA, we can rewrite, this is E dot dA over the surface, we can rewrite this as the integral over the volume of the divergence of the electric field, dV. And that is equal to Q enclosed. What is Q enclosed? Q enclosed is rho dV over the volume, over epsilon naught. So by looking at the fact that we have the same integral being done on both sides, this allows us to say that the divergence of the electric field is equal to rho over epsilon naught. And that would be the differential form of Gauss's law.
If you have that intuition, if you have that intuition of the divergence that I told you about a second ago, remember, if I have an electric field in some region and I have no charges, no charge density, that field is just going to be constant. So I will have no divergence. So if I have charge density there, then it's clearly going to have some field lines going in and out. So I'll have a divergence. Yes?
So with the operator, when you wrote the divergence theorem, the vector V and dV is a completely independent V, right? The V would be the field and dV is the volume. The volume V, right?
Yeah. I just used the same symbol for both for maximal confusion.
And worse than that, had you not really pointed out to me, I would never have even noticed. So you get so used to some of this by context. This V is the vector field, and this V is the volume. Which V is that? That's the volume. Yeah, okay. So, see? You can tell the difference if you look at the V's just right. You can tell if it's one thing. I should have chosen a different thing. But you know, usually it's sort of funny. You have vector fields are often given by vector V's or vector A's. Of course, if I use a vector A, then we have another issue here. So, I don't know. Could make up some bizarre Greek letter, but we usually reserve that for field theory, so I don't know. Okay. We have the no monopole equation. says that the integral of B dot dA over the surface is equal to zero. So the integral over the surface of B dot dA can be rewritten as the integral over the volume of the divergence of the B field, and that's equal to zero, and that gives us the differential form of Maxwell's second equation, which is that the divergence of B is equal to zero. It can't diverge if you don't have little sources or sinkholes for the field itself. So instead of doing the dot product of del with a vector, we could do the cross product. This is defined as the curl of the vector field, and sometimes is even written curl V. Okay. So in order to take the curl in Cartesian coordinates, I want to evaluate this determinant. So this will be equal to I hat times the derivative with respect to x. No, of y, of vz minus the derivative with respect to z of vy minus j hat of the derivative with respect to x of vz minus the derivative of vy with respect to z plus k hat, the derivative with respect to x of vy, minus the derivative with respect to y of vx. I think I got that right this time. And here I think the intuition of just looking at this is not so obvious. The intuition that I would like you to carry around about curl, and as you begin to do problems and you evaluate the curl, you may begin to sort of see how this makes sense. But it is the degree of circulation of the field about a point. That would be the curl of the field at that point. So if you have a field that sort of looks like this about that point, this would have a large curl. A field that is constant will have zero curl because there's no circulation of the field. A field that emanates from a point, so it clearly sort of has a maximal divergence here, this also would have a zero curl. Okay? So you can imagine the B field around the wire has a lot of curl. Right? But the electric field emanating from a point charge has zero curl. So between the two of them, you actually get a lot of... you have a pretty good description of what's happening with the field at a given point. Because one measures how much it sort of increases or decreases as you move away from that point, and the other tells you how much it might transversely go as you go around from the point, go away from the point. So now I'd like to pull out of a hat a theorem called Stokes' theorem. And what Stokes' theorem says is that the integral as you go around a closed loop of v dot dl is equal to the integral over the surface of the curl of v integrated over the area. It has to be a dot product. The curl is a vector, remember. Okay, so how to think about that? Imagine that I have some curve, and what I want to calculate on the left-hand side is if I have that curve made up of all these little elements dl, then as I go around, I'm basically summing the degree to which the vector field v sort of adds as you go around, okay? Which,
if the vector field v is all in one direction, basically it'll give you zero because v is going with ds this way and against ds that way. But if the vector field is circulating, it's all going to sum up and give you something large.
The right-hand side is a measure of the dot product of the curl at every point with the differential area at that point, and you add it up.
So it's sort of a measure
of the degree to which the field does this at all the little points.
And if you look at what's happening here, on this outer side, if the field has sort of this non-zero curl in the same direction, you know, at every point, then down here, the field is always going to be off to the right, and up here, it's always going to be off to the left. So if I sum all of these up, you'll end up getting some large non-zero thing. So intuitively, I hope it makes some sense that summing up the curl over all these little differential area points in here can give you a measure of this thing that you're used to thinking of Ampere's law, sort of the degree to which you get this non-zero circulation around that one curve.
Again, I'm not proving this to you. This is a mathematical description of things, and probably maybe you get it proven in certain calc classes here or whatever. Maybe in 217. And I don't remember exactly why I'm not proving it to you right now. I didn't look because at some point I made a decision it wasn't worth our time. It wasn't like I can't prove it to you or wouldn't want to prove it to you or you can't do it. I just have to make choices about the time. But I didn't go back and review, so I can't tell you exactly why. Anyway, I clearly decided it wasn't worth our while at some point. Anyway, we now have an equation, which was Faraday's law, which is the integral of E dot dl, which is a measure of the EMF, the induced EMF, right? Is equal to d phi m over dt. I can rewrite this left-hand side using Stokes' theorem as the integral over the surface of the curl of E dot in dA. And this is minus d by dt, the integral over the surface of B dot dA. Right? So now I have an expression that relates this curl and B, basically. B both integrated over the same surface. So I'm going to, I can basically pull the integral out, and what you end up with when you pull out, when you make the integral go away, is that you have del cross E is equal to minus dB over dt. And this would be the differential form of Faraday's law. Remember that B field can be in any direction, so you actually have to be careful here.
This now is a function of x, y, and z. This is now a vector. So this equation actually represents a series of scalar equations, right? I have the x component of this is going to be the partial derivative of b and the x, etc.
Then we take Ampere's law, and I now can rewrite the left-hand piece. Remember, Stokes allows me to take the dot product of this vector around the curve and set it equal to this curl quantity. So I can take this thing, and this becomes the integral over the surface of del cross B dotted into dA. So I now have these three quantities, same integral. I have this curl over here, I have j dot dA here, and I have this derivative with respect to time of this of e dot dA. So again, basically I can get rid of the integrals in all three terms and pull out the other pieces. So I have the curl of B is equal to mu zero times j plus mu zero times epsilon naught times the change of E with respect to time.
If we ignore this term for a moment, I hope this makes a little sense to you, in the sense that if I have a current, I know I have a circulating B around it, right? So it will give me a curl. If I have no current, I'll have no circulating B around it. So I'll have zero curl. This term is sort of new, right? It adds this time dependence in. Sort of interesting, it's not so different from the time dependence you see up above, right? We have the curl depends on the time change of B. Here you have the curl of B depending on the time change of B. Here, your intuition is you're inducing this EMF. So you're inducing the EMF in the loop around where you have this changing B, changing magnetic flux. This term that Maxwell added is really important because it gives you sort of the symmetrical piece here in B and E. If I now tell you I have a changing E, it gives me a curling B. Okay? So let's write all these things down on the same page now.
This is now what we call the differential form. Of Maxwell's equations. And now with the differential form, what's happening, I think, is a little more clear.
There's a lot of stuff that's happening. There's a lot of information. Right? This tells you that you have point charges in the electric field. This tells you in electricity. Here it says we have no magnetic monopoles, the divergence being zero. Look at these two things, though. Imagine we live in a world where we have no current for the moment. Let's suppose I take a handful of charge and I just do this. Okay? Then in this region of space, I clearly have a non-zero changing electric field. That means in this region of space, I will have a curling B. So as I do this, I will get a B field doing this. If I now have a B field that goes from zero to doing something, I have a non-zero time dependence of the B, which, as you know, if I have a changing B flux through some region, it induces an electric field. And I get a curling E around that. I have a changing electric field curling, which gives me a non-zero ddt, which gives me a curling B. I have a couple differential equations. I wiggle some charge here, and I get a B field, which gives me an E field, which gives me a B field, which gives me an E field, and they're just completely coupled together. And this whole thing, which we will calculate probably next time, maybe this time, this whole phenomenon propagates outward at the speed of light. So if I wiggle this really fast, I get high frequency light because the fields are changing very quickly. And if I wiggle this very slowly, I get low frequency light because it's moving very slowly. And that is the essence of light, as it turns out. And I would argue that this is perhaps one of the most beautiful, if not the most beautiful, magnificent creations ever to come out of the human mind. Remember when we talked about the electric field
the first time?
We had something very real. We had a force. See the force. You can measure the force. We pulled the electric field out of our butt just as a way of describing the force. That way we could talk about some weird condition in space over here that this thing might... So we could get rid of this charge because it complicates things to always talk about forces. So we wanted to talk about a condition in space that this charge could create. Right? And you sort of play the same game with the magnetic field, around bar magnets or whatever. Now you tell me, is the electric field real? Is the magnetic field real? There's no charge. Well, there's a little. You can be in a charge-free, current-free region. Okay, I could be in a region of space where there's no charge and no current. And if I wiggle, okay, so I have some charge out here, but you know, if I do something where I change one, B or E or whatever, this thing just goes to town. And it doesn't require anything else to do it. And light, sure as hell, is real. Now, we're gonna do... to stop and think what we're going to do, actually. We are going to extract the speed of this. We're going to look at the nature of electromagnetic waves coming out of this. So we're going to do a lot of that. having done that, I can't actually remember whether we extract optical laws, but you certainly will in 217, and it's easy to do. You can take these equations and extract optics out of it. You know, optics is where you have electric and magnetic fields entering materials like glass, and, you know, Snell's laws, it gets bent and everything. That's totally buried in here, okay? You can just extract that right out. So there's no question at all in anybody's mind that these equations describe the nature of light. Until you start worrying about quantum stuff, and then this is the classical nature of light. Okay.
They're also, you know,
I don't know how to say this. If you're geeky enough, they're beautiful. But just a wee bit of, right? If I'm in a world where I have no current and no charge, I have a lovely symmetry in here. Right? Curl of E is time change of B. Curl of B is time change of E. Divergence of B and divergence of E are zero. It's all nice. If I lived in a world where I had magnetic monopoles, then I get a non-zero magnetic monopole term here, and I'll have some other weird term over here, and again, I've restored symmetry. That alone is sufficient to launch magnetic monopole surges. How could nature possibly be so perverse as to give us something so close to having perfect symmetry, but not quite? So people really do believe magnetic monopoles exist, actually, and have gone looking for them. And I think I mentioned to you, in fact, in cosmology and stuff, people actually think in the early stage of the universe, there was enough energy that magnetic monopoles might have been created. But then the universe went through this very strange period of inflation in a very, very short period of time where it just got vastly larger than the observable universe. It's a strange story. If you're actually interested in it, you want a place to start with lots of references, I've written a book called Visions of the Multiverse where I try to sort of, in a hand-waving way, explain all this stuff. It has to be in a hand-waving way, because I'm no cosmologist, so I can't do math for it. But I have tried to understand conceptually how to do it all and try to explain it. But at any rate, so what happens is the universe has some magnetic monopole density and it just gets massively big, so that if you take the observable universe, their magnetic monopole density is gone to zero, which is why we don't see them anymore. So the theoreticians still hold on to it, but the universe in which we live, the equations which you will use if you want to design something, use something, you want to understand light, unfortunately are a little bit of, because you don't have magnetic monopoles. But they are actually sort of beautiful. So when you have had a couple of drinks with your philosophy friends and you want to have fun, or artistic friends, you know, you can have a nice discussion about why it is that things that are sort of mathematically beautiful often seem to translate into something in reality, or vice versa. But it's not perfect, right? Because these really are beautiful, and so you would look at it, and it has a good sense about it, and it turns out to be a really important reality. It's probably a good place to stop, because the next thing I want to do is just rip the crap out of these equations and extract what it means for E and P and how we can get the nature of light out of it.